father of a university. After leaving the presidency, Jefferson continued to be active in public affairs. He also became increasingly concerned with founding a new institution of higher learning, specifically one free of church influences, where students could specialize in many new areas not offered at other universities. Jefferson believed educating people was a good way to establish an organized society, and also felt schools should be paid for by the general public, so less wealthy people could obtain student membership as well. A letter to Joseph Priestley in January 1800 indicated that he had been planning the university for decades before its establishment. His dream was realized in 1819 with the founding of the University of Virginia. Upon its opening in 1825, it was then the first university to offer a full slate of elective courses to its students. One of the largest construction projects to that time in North America, it was notable for being centered about a library rather than a church. In fact, no campus chapel was included in his original plans. Until his death, Jefferson invited students and faculty of the school to his home. Edgar Allan Poe was among those students. Jefferson is widely recognized for his architectural planning of the University of Virginia grounds. An innovative design that's a powerful representation of his aspirations for both state-sponsored education and an agrarian democracy in the new republic. His educational idea of creating specialized units of learning is physically expressed in the configuration of his campus plan, which he called the Academical Village. Individual academic units are expressed visually as distinct structures, represented by pavilions facing a grassy quadrangle, with each pavilion housing classroom, faculty office, and residences. Though unique, each is individually equal in importance, and they're linked together with a series of open-air arcades that are the front facades of student accommodations. Gardens and vegetable plots are placed behind, surrounded by serpentine walls, affirming the importance of the agrarian lifestyle. His highly ordered site plan establishes an ensemble of buildings surrounding a central rectangular quadrangle named the Lawn, which is lined on either side with the academic teaching units and their linking arcades. The quad is closed at one end with the library, the repository of knowledge, at the head of the table. The remaining side opposite the library remained open-ended for future growth. The lawn rises gradually as a series of stepped terraces, each a few feet higher than the last, rising to the library set in the most prominent position at the top, while also suggesting that the academical village facilitates easier movement to the future. Stylistically, Jefferson was a proponent of the Greek and Roman styles, which he believed to be the most representative of American democracy by historical association. Each academic unit is designed with a two-story temple front facing the quadrangle, while the library is modeled on the Roman Pantheon. The ensemble of buildings surrounding the quad is an unmistakable architectural statement of the importance of secular public education, while the exclusion of religious structures reinforces the principle of separation of church and state. The campus planning and architectural treatment remains today as a paradigm of the ordering of the man-made structures to express intellectual ideas and aspirations. A survey of the members of the American Institute of Architects identified Jefferson's campus as the most significant work of architecture in America. The university was designed as the capstone of the educational system of Virginia. In his vision, any citizen of the Commonwealth could attend school with the sole criterion being ability. Jefferson's death. Jefferson died on the 4th of July, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence. He died a few hours before the death of John Adams, his compatriot in their quest for independence, then great political rival, and later friend and correspondent. Adams is often rumored to have referenced Jefferson in his last words, unaware of his passing. Although he was born into one of the wealthiest families in the United States, Thomas Jefferson was deeply in debt when he died. His possessions were sold at auction. In 1831, Jefferson's 552 acres were sold for $7,000 to James T. Barclay. Thomas Jefferson is buried on his Monticello estate in Charlottesville, Virginia. In his will, he left Monticello to the United States to be used as a school for orphans of Navy officers. His epitaph, written by him with an insistence that only his words and not a word more be inscribed, reads, "Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of American Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia." Below the epitaph, on a separate panel, is written, "Born April 2, 1743 O.S. Died July 4, 1826. The initials O.S. are a notation for old style, and that is a reference to the change of dating that occurred during Jefferson's lifetime from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar under the British calendar, New Style Act, 1750. Appearance and temperament. Jefferson's been described by many people as a thin, tall man who stood at approximately 6 feet and remarkably straight. The Sage of Monticello cultivated an image that earned him the other nickname, Man of the People. He affected a popular air by greeting White House guests in homespun attire like a robe and slippers. Dolly Madison, wife of James Madison, Jefferson's Secretary of State, and Jefferson's daughters relaxed White House protocol and turned formal state dinners into more casual and entertaining social events. Although a foremost defender of a free press, Jefferson at times sparred with partisan newspapers and appealed to the people. Jefferson's writings were utilitarian and evidenced great intellect, and he had an affinity for languages. He learned Gaelic in order to translate Ossian and sent to James McPherson for the originals. As president, he discontinued the practice of delivering the State of the Union address in person, instead sending the address to Congress in writing. The practice of delivering the State of the Union address was eventually revived by Woodrow Wilson. Jefferson gave only 2 public speeches during his presidency. Jefferson had a lisp and preferred writing to public speaking partly because of the lisp. He burned all of his letters between himself and his wife at her death, creating the portrait of a man who at times could be very private. Indeed, he preferred working in the privacy of his office rather than in the public eye. Interests and activities. Jefferson was an accomplished architect who was extremely influential in bringing the Neo-Palladian style, popular among the Whig aristocracy of Britain, to the United States. The style was associated with Enlightenment ideas of Republican civic virtue and political liberty. Jefferson designed his famous home, Monticello, near Charlottesville, Virginia. It included automatic doors, the first swivel chair, and other convenient devices invented by Jefferson. Nearby is the only university ever to have been founded by a U.S. president, the University of Virginia, of which the original curriculum and architecture Jefferson designed. Today, Monticello and the University of Virginia are together one of only 4 man-made World Heritage Sites in the United States of America. Jefferson also designed Poplar Forest, near Lynchburg, in Bedford County, Virginia, as a private retreat from a very public life. Jefferson is also credited with the architectural design of the Virginia State Capitol building, which was modeled after the Maison Carrée at Nîmes in southern France, an ancient Roman temple. Jefferson's buildings helped initiate the ensuing American fashion for federal architecture. Jefferson's interests included archaeology, a discipline then in its infancy. He's sometimes been called the father of archaeology in recognition of his role in developing excavation techniques. When exploring an Indian burial mound on his Virginia estate in 1784, Jefferson avoided the common practice of simply digging downwards until something turned up. Instead, he cut a wedge out of the mound so he could walk into it, look at the layers of occupation, and draw conclusions from them. Thomas Jefferson enjoyed his fish pond at Monticello. It was around 3 feet deep and mortar-lined. He used the pond to keep fish that were recently caught, as well as to keep eels fresh. This pond has been restored and can be seen from the west side of Monticello. In 1780, he joined Benjamin Franklin's American Philosophical Society. He served as president of the society from 1797 to 1815. Jefferson was an avid wine lover and noted gourmet. During his years in France, 1784 to 1789, he took extensive trips through France and other European wine regions and sent the best back home. He's noted for the bold pronouncement, "We could, in the United States, make as great a variety of wines as are made in Europe, not exactly of the same kinds, but doubtless as good." While there were extensive vineyards planted at Monticello, a significant portion were of the European wine grape, Vitis vinifera, and did not survive the many vine diseases native to the Americas. In 1801, he published a manual of parliamentary practice that's still in use. In 1812, Jefferson published a second edition. After the British burned Washington, D.C. in the Library of Congress in August 1814, Jefferson offered his own collection to the nation. In January 1815, Congress accepted his offer, appropriating $23,950 for his 6,487 books, and the foundation was laid for a great national library. Today, the Library of Congress website for federal legislative information is called Thomas in honor of Jefferson. His two-volume 1764 edition of the Koran was used by Representative Keith Ellison in 2007 for his swearing-in to the House of Representatives. Political philosophy. Jefferson was a leader in developing republicanism in the United States. He insisted that the British aristocratic system was inherently corrupt and that Americans' devotion to civic virtue required independence. In the 1790s, he repeatedly warned that Hamilton and Adams were trying to impose a British-like monarchical system that threatened republicanism. He supported the War of 1812, hoping it would drive away the British military and ideological threat from Canada. Jefferson's vision for American virtue was that of an agricultural nation of yeoman farmers minding their own affairs. It stood in contrast to the vision of Alexander Hamilton, who envisioned a nation of commerce and manufacturing, which Jefferson said offered too many temptations to corruption. Jefferson's deep belief in the uniqueness and the potential of America made him the father of American exceptionalism. In particular, he was confident that an underpopulated America could avoid what he considered the horrors of class-divided industrialized Europe. Jefferson's Republican political principles were heavily influenced by the Country Party of 18th-century British opposition writers. He was influenced by John Locke, particularly relating to the principle of inalienable rights. Historians find few traces of any influence by his French contemporary, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. His opposition to the Bank of the United States was fierce. "I sincerely believe with you that banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies, and that the principle of spending money to be paid by posterity under the name of funding is but swindling futurity on a large scale." Nevertheless, Madison in Congress, seeing the financial chaos caused by the lack of a national bank in the War of 1812, disregarded Jefferson's advice and created the Second Bank of the United States in 1816. Jefferson believed that each individual has certain inalienable rights. That is, these rights exist with or without government. Man cannot create, take, or give them away. It's the right of liberty on which Jefferson is most notable for expounding. He defines it by saying, "Rightful liberty is unobstructed action according to our will within limits drawn around us by the equal rights of others. I do not add within the limits of the law, because law is often but the tyrant's will, and always so when it violates the rights of the individual." Hence, for Jefferson, though government cannot create a right to liberty, it can indeed violate it. And the limit of an individual's rightful liberty is not what law says it is, but is simply a matter of stopping short of prohibiting other individuals from having the same liberty. A proper government for Jefferson is one that not only prohibits individuals in society from infringing on the liberty of others, but also restrains itself from diminishing individual liberty. Jefferson's commitment to equality was expressed in his successful efforts to abolish primogeniture in Virginia, the rule by which the firstborn son inherited all the land. Jefferson believed that individuals have an innate sense of morality that prescribes right from wrong when dealing with other individuals, that whether they choose to restrain themselves or not, they have an innate sense of the natural rights of others. He even believed that moral sense to be reliable enough that an anarchist society could function well, provided that it was reasonably small. On several occasions, he expressed admiration for tribal communal way of living of Native Americans. In fact, Jefferson is sometimes seen as a philosophical anarchist. He said in a letter to Colonel Carrington, "I am convinced that those societies, as the Indians, which live without government, enjoy in their general mass an infinitely greater degree of happiness than those who live under the European governments." However, Jefferson believed anarchism to be inconsistent with any great degree of population. Hence, he did advocate government for the American expanse, provided that it exists by consent of the governed. In the preamble to his original draft of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson wrote, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable, that all men are created equal and independent, that from that equal creation they derive rights inherent and inalienable, among which are the preservation of life and liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these ends governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government shall become destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to effect their safety and happiness." Jefferson's dedication to consent of the governed was so thorough that he believed that individuals could not morally be bound by the actions of preceding generations. This included debts as well as law. He said that no society can make a perpetual constitution or even a perpetual law. The earth belongs always to the living generation. He even calculated what he believed to be the proper cycle of legal revolution. Every constitution, then, and every law naturally expires at the end of 19 years. If it's enforced longer, it's an act of force and not of right. He arrived at 19 years through calculations with expectancy of life tables, taking into account what he believed to be the age of maturity, when an individual is able to reason for himself. He also advocated that the national debt should be eliminated. He did not believe that living individuals had a moral obligation to repay the debts of previous generations. He said that repaying such debts was a question of generosity and not of right. Jefferson's very strong defense of states' rights, especially in the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions of 1798, set the tone for hostility to expansion of federal powers. However, some of his foreign policies did in fact strengthen the government. Most important was the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, when he used the implied powers to annex a huge foreign territory and all its French and Indian inhabitants. His enforcement of the Embargo Act of 1807, while it failed in terms of foreign policy, demonstrated that the federal government could intervene with great force at the local level in controlling trade that might lead to war. Views on carrying arms. Jefferson's commitment to liberty extended to many areas of individual freedom. In his commonplace book, he copied a passage from Chazaré, Marquis of Beccaria, related to the issue of gun control. The quote reads, "Laws that forbid the carrying of arms disarm only those who are neither inclined nor determined to commit crimes. Such laws make things worse for the assaulted and better for the assailants. They serve rather to encourage than to prevent homicides, for an unarmed man may be attacked with greater confidence than an armed man." View on corporations. Jefferson's quote, I hope we shall crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations, which dare already to challenge our government to a trial of strength and bid defiance to the laws of our country. Is often attributed to being a strong warning against corporations and their function in American government and society. Views on Judiciary. Trained as a lawyer, Jefferson was a great writer, but never a good speaker or advocate, and never comfortable in court. He believed that judges should be technical specialists, but should not set policy. He denounced the 1801 Supreme Court ruling in Marbury v. Madison as a violation of democracy. But he did not have enough support in Congress to propose a constitutional amendment to overturn it. He continued to oppose the doctrine of judicial review, quoting from Jefferson's writing here. To consider the judges as the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions is a very dangerous doctrine indeed, and one which would place us under the despotism of an oligarchy. Our judges are as honest as other men, and not more so. They have with others the same passions for party, for power, and the privilege of their corps. Their maxim is, good justice is broad jurisdiction, and their power is the more dangerous as they are in office for life and not responsible, as the other functionaries are, to the elective control. The Constitution has erected no such single tribunal, knowing that to whatever hands confided, with the corruptions of time and party, its members would become despots. It's more wisely made all the departments co-equal and co-sovereign within themselves. Views on Political Violence. Concerning Shay's rebellion after he had heard of the bloodshed, Jefferson wrote to William S. Smith, John Adams' son-in-law, "What signify a few lives lost in a century or two? The tree of liberty must from time to time be refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is its natural manure." View on Self-Esteem. In a letter to Francis Hopkinson of March 13, 1789, Jefferson wrote, "I never had an opinion in politics or religion which I was afraid to own. A cost of reserve on these subjects might have procured me more esteem from some people, but less from myself." Religious Views. Though his religious views diverted widely from the orthodox Christianity of the day, throughout his life Jefferson was intensely interested in theology, spirituality, and biblical study. His religious commitment is probably best summarized in his own words as he proclaimed that he belonged to a sect with just one member. Jefferson's conclusions about the Bible are noteworthy. He considered much of the New Testament of the Bible to be false. He described these as so much untruth, charlatanism, and imposture. He described the roguery of others of his disciples and called them a band of dupes and impostors, describing Paul as the first corrupter of the doctrines of Jesus, and wrote of palpable interpolations and falsifications. He also described the book of Revelation to be merely the ravings of a maniac, no more worthy nor capable of explanation than the incoherences of our own nightly dreams. While living in the White House, Jefferson began to make his own condensed version of the Gospels, omitting the virgin birth of Jesus, miracles attributed to Jesus, divinity, and the resurrection of Jesus, thus primarily leaving only Jesus' moral philosophy, of which he approved. This compilation, titled The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, extracted textually from the Gospels' Greek, Latin, French, and English, was published after his death and became known as the Jefferson Bible. Jefferson was raised in the Church of England at a time when it was the established church in Virginia and only denomination funded by Virginia tax money. Avery Dulles, a leading Catholic theologian, reports, "In his college years at William and Mary, Jefferson came to admire Francis Bacon, Isaac Newton, and John Locke as three great paragons of wisdom. Under the influence of several professors, he converted to the deist philosophy." Dulles concludes, In summary, then, Jefferson was a deist because he believed in one God, in divine providence, in the divine moral law, and in rewards and punishments after death. But he did not believe in supernatural revelation. He was a Christian deist because he saw Christianity as the highest expression of natural religion and Jesus as an incomparably great moral teacher. He was not an Orthodox Christian because he rejected, among other things, the doctrines that Jesus was the promised Messiah and the incarnate Son of God. Jefferson's religion is fairly typical of the American form of deism of his day. Before the Revolution, Jefferson was a vestryman in his local church, a lay position that was informally tied to political office at the time. He also had friends who were clergy, and he supported some churches financially. His last words were, "I resign myself to my God, and my child to my country."